Okay, the next case is number 08-5175, Anchor Savings Bank against the United States. Mr. Todor.
May it please the court, and I've requested 5 minutes for rebuttal. The trial court erred in this case by finding that the breach caused Anchor to sell a subsidiary, Residential Funding Corporation, or RFC. It erred by measuring damages for that sale based upon the profits that another company earned while owning RFC after the breach rather than RFC's value at the time of the breach. And finally, the trial court erred by finding that the type and magnitude of damages was reasonably foreseeable to the government at the time of contracting, well before Anchor ever purchased RFC.
Is your theory that if there's a problem with foreseeability, then there should be no damages? They need to be estimated, don't they?
Here, the type of damages was not foreseeable because Anchor did not own RFC at the time of the breach, so there should be no damages for RFC's purchase or later sale. If the court finds that the acquisition of RFC was foreseeable, nevertheless, the magnitude of damages awarded at the trial court was not foreseeable. The evidence for this is that the contemporaneous valuations of RFC at the time of the sale showed that the true value estimated by Anchor's investment advisors was $67 million. The price Anchor received for that $64.4 million was very close to that. There's simply no evidence to support that Anchor at the time of the sale could have foreseen that the sale of RFC would have cost it the over $300 million awarded for that by the trial court. Therefore, under a reasonable foreseeability standard, the magnitude of those damages was not foreseeable, even if the type of damages, the acquisition of a company such as RFC, was foreseeable.
So this is a characteristic of all of the FIREA cases, isn't it, that you legislate an accounting change and consequences then flow?
Yes, but as this court found, for example, in Old Stone, applying Section 351 of the Restatement of Contracts, the loss that actually occurred must be foreseeable. Here, the notion that the breach would require Anchor to sell a subsidiary, RFC, that it didn't even own at the time of contracting was not foreseeable.
When is the time of breach?
The breach was, I believe, in December of 1989 when the implementing regulations took hold.
Not at the time of the passage of FIREA? Because at that point they did own RFC, right?
They owned RFC as of June of 1988, so it was prior to either of those events. The time of contracting, which is the time from which foreseeability must be determined, however, was back in 1983, so it was more than 3 years, even after the last of the acquisitions, 1985, until they acquired RFC. And there was no reason for the government to have been able to foresee at the time of contracting that Anchor would buy RFC, a subsidiary in a line of business it wasn't part of, that Anchor would have to sell RFC rather than other assets in response to the breach, as per Old Stone, where the sale of the crown jewels was found not to be foreseeable when the company had access to alternative forms of capital.
But perhaps also if it was foreseeable that 6 years later there would be an act of Congress to change the rules, perhaps the entire situation would have been different.
The question is what was reasonably foreseeable to the government at the time of contracting. Even if a change in the capital regulations was foreseeable, it doesn't mean that the loss that actually occurred was foreseeable.
But here's the problem I have with the whole issue of foreseeable. One of the problems, foreseeability, I think, is one of the most vexing questions in contract law. But the problem, it seems to me, comes down to this, that the government got this company to take over these thrifts, despite their having something like $650 million in net liabilities. So it's coming in with a huge negative factor. So they wouldn't presumably have taken these things over without some substantial inducement. The inducement, of course, was principally the goodwill treatment of the regulatory capital, right? I mean, that was the sweetener that made an otherwise non-starter into a viable deal.
That was one of the factors. There was also substantial financial assistance in many of those
transactions. Suppose you subtract the financial assistance. I don't know whether that was present in this transaction or not, but how much of it was. But subtract that. You still have a substantial component of the difference between making the deal go and not making the deal go was the regulatory capital. That regulatory capital necessarily translates in the mind of somebody who's looking at whether to take on these liabilities into prospect for profit, and the government necessarily knew that. That was why it was valuable, because it provided a prospect for profit. Therefore, it's difficult to say, well, you know, it doesn't really amount to very much. In fact, it really only comes ultimately in the form of the valuation of RFC when it's ultimately sold to a couple of $1 million difference between the distress price and the fair market value. That seems disproportionate to me.
Terms of the amount of goodwill is not relevant to whether the loss that actually occurred was foreseeable from the purchase and later sale of RFC.
Well, but we can start with the proposition that if it's true that the amount of goodwill was such as to overcome $650 million worth of net liabilities, or some significant chunk of that, then the government must have understood that if they took that away, they would be endangering their contracting partner to a roughly equivalent amount, don't you think?
There would be some need to replace the capital or shrink the bank or take other actions, but that action does not mean that the later acquisition and sale of RFC was foreseeable, and it doesn't mean that the magnitude of damages that RFC earned under its new owner, as opposed to what was known to Anchor at the time of the breach when it said in its capital plan that it did not foresee any damage from the sale, and the regulator said they wouldn't have approved the sale if they knew that there would be damage to Anchor's franchise from the sale. If the magnitude of those damages is not foreseeable from that particular transaction, or something that was reasonably foreseeable to the government at the time of contracting, notwithstanding the amount of goodwill, that loss is not foreseeable.
Why is the amount not foreseeable? I mean, Anchor's in the business to make money. They're going to be leveraging this capital, supervisory goodwill, to buy other things and invest in it. Why is the amount not foreseeable?
The amount of goodwill does not make the amount of the judgment foreseeable, because Anchor represented in its capital plan and its own internal investment analyses did not project such damage even at the time of sale. If Anchor couldn't have foreseen damage at the time of sale, the government certainly couldn't have foreseen damage from the loss that actually occurred, the sale of RFC, at the time of contracting. This folds into the trial court's measure of damages. Trial court measured the damages by the profits GMAC earned while operating RFC after the breach. Again, this measure was not reasonably foreseeable, and it's just a wrong measure of damages for the sale of an income-generating property, as this court instructed in the first Federal Lincoln Bank case. The reason for this is that the market value of an income-generating asset at the time of the breach reflects what the market knows about the future riskiness of that business. The market could not foresee that RFC was going to earn the kinds of profits that it ultimately earned under GMAC at the time of the breach. That's why the price was estimated and was found to be $64 million instead of over $300 million. If the market could have foreseen over $300 million of losses as to Anchor from the sale, as the trial court found, presumably that price would have been higher.
Yeah, but the market, I'm not sure that it's fair to say that the, what the market foresees necessarily dictates lost profits. Now, as you know, First Lincoln disposed of the lost profits argument and went to the asset disposition question as to the, as its basis for proceeding to analyze market value. But if you're right that lost profits always have to be tied to the what the market assesses at a priori as the likelihood of the ultimate discounted value of the company going forward, then you know Warren Buffett would not be a rich man today. I mean, it's people who say this is a great deal, even though the market doesn't know it, that can that's where people make money. And here they had what turned out, we know, to be a great deal, better than the market estimated. Now, why aren't they entitled to the benefit of that best, of that good deal, if the the RFC operation was, as they submit and is found, essentially done in the same manner under GMAC as it would have been done by this company?
In short form, because the government could not have foreseen that Anchor
would
have
been lost
3 years later.
We're talking now about quantum of damages. I thought we had left foreseeability.
And with respect
for
to quantum of damages, right. First Federal Lincoln is an asset disposition case. This is an asset disposition case.
Well, but it, unless you say it, all lost profits questions in this kind of setting are asset disposition cases, and I'm not sure that's...
Well, here we do have an asset disposition. There was a sale. The plaintiffs, when they're choosing to apply... the First Federal Lincoln Court did not say plaintiffs had the choice whether to apply lost profits in hindsight if they were higher than what the difference in market price at the time of the breach was. That's because that's not reasonably foreseeable. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I would...
do you have an answer to your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tenderman. Mr. Fountain.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. This is one of the last remaining Winstar cases, and it presents one of the strongest lost profits claims that has been submitted to this Court for two reasons. First, Anchor's claim does not involve some hypothetical asset or investment portfolio that it claims it would have owned but for the breach. Rather, it claims profits from the sale of a subsidiary that the loss of $600 million of regulatory capital forced it to sell. And second, Anchor is not claiming some hypothetical stream of profits that were not actually observed in the real world. Rather, it claims as its damages the profits that RFC subsequently earned operating under the same management, executing the same business plan as it had while it was still owned by Anchor.
But don't you have to deal foremost with this letter from your own CEO that attributes the sale of RFC, at least in part, to non-breaching aspects of FIREA?
The key to your question, Judge Rader, is at least in part. And what is clear is that the non-breaching risk-based capital provisions of FIREA operating in conjunction with the loss of $600 million of breached regulatory capital caused the problems for Anchor. It is not the case that with the additional capital, with the breached capital, that Anchor still would have had to sell RFC solely because of the non-breaching risk-based capital provisions. The November 8 memo from Mr. Large never identifies it as a sole cause of the breach. And we presented at trial extensive evidence, both factual and through expert witnesses, showing that had Anchor still enjoyed the capital that was taken away by FIREA, it would have comfortably operated RFC as it was actually operated by GMAC. It would have met its capital ratios.
That's another difficult aspect of the proof, isn't it? No other thrift took this kind of aggressive tact that GMAC took, is there speculation in whether or not Anchor would have departed from normal course of business and have done what GMAC did?
The trial court found that there was not speculation, Your Honor. And the key is that RFC submitted a strategic plan to Anchor in May of 1989. And by the way, that was at a point in time when Anchor already knew that the risk-based capital guidelines were coming. To go back to the timeline, the FIREA bill was introduced in Congress in February. And Anchor knew then that risk-based capital was likely to be part of the regulation, likely to be part of the statute.
And it passed?
The statute passed in August. What Anchor didn't know
in August... This is 88, right?
89. What Anchor did not know as of August was whether it would be grandfathered out of the goodwill provisions because of its contracts with the government. And as the trial court found, Anchor did not know that it would lose the $157 million of preferred stock that also counted toward its regulatory capital. That was not clear until the end of October when the implementing regulations were promulgated. But throughout that planning period, from February to October of 1989, and knowing that the risk-based capital provisions were coming down the pike, Anchor continued to plan not just to hold, but to expand RFC. And as we point out in our brief, in every single planning document, Anchor says things like, RFC is authorized to double its volume. We've got a winner on our hands. We're going to stand back and let them fly. We've got a number of those quotations in our brief. But to the point, did Anchor do something that was speculative? Are we claiming that something was speculative? If you look to the May 1989 strategic plan that RFC submitted to Anchor's board and the board approved, again, with the knowledge of risk-based capital guidelines coming, as the trial court found, RFC's management under GMAC went out and executed that business plan to a T. And so there is nothing that GMAC did that RFC would not have. In fact, Anchor's experts found that by employing different different alternatives to lay off the recourse represented by RFC and the capital requirements associated with that recourse, in order to comply with the risk-based capital guidelines, Anchor actually would have saved $170 million over what GMAC did, because GMAC simply self-insured for that risk and took the losses. So there was nothing GMAC did that was unusual compared to what RFC was planning.
Let me focus, if I could, on foreseeability. The restatement states that the mere circumstance that some loss was foreseeable, or even that some loss of the same general kind was foreseeable, will not suffice if the loss that actually occurred was not foreseeable. Why isn't that rather narrow characterization, which essentially states the rule of Hadley against Baxendale, why isn't that the kind of characterization that fits well with this case?
Because the loss that actually occurred here, as it relates to the contract, was the loss of the goodwill. The particular asset was not the subject of the contract. The subject of the contract was the goodwill.
But the damages, the loss, the injury of which you're complaining, is the ultimate loss of the profits of RFC. So goodwill is not the damage. So what the restatement seems to be saying is you have to point to the ultimate injury as having been foreseeable, not just in general, but the specific kind of injury.
And I think this court answered that question, Judge Bryson, in both Citizens Federal and Fifth Third. Both of those cases first reiterate CalFed and also the Supreme Court statement in Winstar that the purpose of these contracts was to leverage up the goodwill, take more assets on your books, generate profits, and it was foreseeable that if you take away the goodwill, the bank would either have to sell assets or raise capital, and it's entitled to the damages it incurs in doing so. And in Citizens, Citizens was a case where the plaintiff was requesting damages not for the cost of replacing its capital, but for certain adverse tax consequences that it suffered as a result of that capital raising. And this court said that it was a sufficient finding that it was foreseeable that the thrift would have to replace the goodwill. And it then goes on to say, there is no requirement that the particular method used to raise that capital or its consequences be foreseeable. So the court there was not concerned with how the thrift raised its capital, only that the thrift had to raise capital. Moreover, it then went on and found that these ancillary tax consequences that flowed from the capital raising were also foreseeable. Fifth Third is very much the same. There, the plaintiff had to sell prematurely in 1991 certain branches that it claims it would have held and sold in 1998 for a higher price. And again, this court said that the need to raise capital was foreseeable. The thrift was not required also to show that the precise economic conditions were foreseeable. And so I think those cases respond to your question and show that the loss, the foreseeable loss, the type of loss at issue in these cases, is the loss of the goodwill and the need to raise capital by selling assets or by some other capital raising measure.
Deal with the Lincoln Bank case, will you, that says discourages lost profits at least.
I would dispute that characterization, Judge Rader. Lincoln is distinguishable on 2 points. First, as it clearly says, it is not a lost profits or expectancy damages case. Second, the plaintiff in Lincoln did not claim that it would have been in some better position sometime post-breach than it was at the time of breach. And I think it's important to look at the Lincoln decision because it begins by quoting Energy Capital. And it notes that there is, it first notes the general rule that contract damages are measured as of the date of the breach. But then it goes on to note the exception to that rule. And for the exception, it quotes Energy Capital. And that exception is, quote, for profits that would have accrued over the course of the contract. In those circumstances, damages are measured throughout the course of the contract. So that is Lincoln reconfirming what this court held in Energy Capital. The Lincoln court then goes on to say, but this is not a lost profits case. The plaintiff tried to prove lost profits at trial. The trial court found that they were not provable with reasonable certainty. And so it turned to the lost value of the deposits as an alternative form of measure. And in that context, in measuring value, then yes, you look to the fair market value as the best available proof. But in terms of putting the plaintiff in the position that it would have been in but for the breach, when lost profits are available as a measure of damages, they are awardable. And if you look at the various authorities that Lincoln cites, starting with Schoenfeld, which is the Second Circuit decision, that too was a case where the plaintiff failed to prove lost profits. The Second Circuit noted that lost profits and fair value are separate and distinct categories of damages, and it then went on to consider the lost value as an alternative measure. Dobbs, Corbin, Williston, all cited in Lincoln, make that same distinction, and they say that you don't get both, but they are alternative measures of damages.
Can you address as well the Namco purchase 7 years after the RFC sale? How is that a mitigation? It's even operated in a different market than the jumbo mortgage market of the RFC venture.
The key to understanding Namco is mitigation, Your Honor, is to understand that beginning in the 1980s, Anchor had a consistent and coherent strategy of getting out of the traditional thrift model of originating mortgages at retail and holding them as whole loans in portfolio as investments, which is what led to the thrift crisis in the first place. And Anchor's strategy was to expand out of that into the mortgage banking market, where Anchor could acquire loans wholesale, where it could convert those mortgages and resell them as mortgage-backed securities, retain the servicing rights on those mortgages as a source of non-interest rate sensitive fee income, where it could use that mortgage banking subsidiary in order to take Anchor's own loans, securitize them, primarily as a means of taking fixed rate loans off the books, converting them to ARMs, taking whole loans, converting them to mortgage-backed securities. That was what the Suburban Coastal deal was all about. So the Suburban transaction facilitated that strategy. The breach interrupted that strategy by forcing Anchor to sell RFC. As soon as Anchor came back into capital compliance, it began looking to resume that strategy, and Namco represented its first opportunity. the trial court had it right because it looked at it from the standpoint of the benefits that the bank derived from Namco and RFC. And those benefits were a nationwide scope of business to diversify geographically. It provided a wholesale volume of loans much more efficiently without the need for brick-and-mortar retail offices.
What about the 7 years, though? What about the 7 years? Is that all recovery period?
Yes, Your Honor. Anchor did not fully come back into capital compliance. There was a series of stages Anchor had to go through to comply with FIREA, and then it had to comply with FIDICIA, the second statute that upped the capital requirements. Anchor did not fully come out of compliance with those statutes until 93 or 94. This is mortgage banking subsidiaries, and then it had to build a cushion to where it would have the capital to make this kind of acquisition.
93 would be 4 years later, but...
Well, the government has never claimed that Anchor could have or should have mitigated sooner, Your Honor. Anchor undertook some deals as part of its other recuperation. It tried to acquire some branch networks that it was unable to do. But there has been no evidence presented in the record that there was some that Anchor had the ability or the opportunity to mitigate before 1997. But the key fact is that in all particulars, as Anchor was interested, they were identical. They provided the exact same benefits. The one distinction between Namco and RFC is that RFC sold these private label jumbo mortgage-backed securities. And the interesting fact there is in 1996, Namco determined to get into that market. But that's not why Anchor bought RFC. Anchor didn't say, we want a private label conduit. Anchor said, we want a mortgage banking conduit that provides us volume of loans, the ability to restructure our loan asset portfolio, a steady source of non-interest dependent fee income, the float on the loans that the bank, that the subsidiary carried on Anchor's warehouse.
That's the largest part of this damages, isn't it, is this mitigation cost?
That's correct, Your Honor. And so the trial court made detailed specific findings that, and I'll quote here, it resolved the bank's need for a substantial origination volume, diverse geographic footprint, sophisticated mortgage banking operation, and reliable source of non-interest fee income. Both assets provided the exact same benefits to Anchor.
If you could address Old Stone Corporation, the court in Old Stone doesn't, I guess, quite say you'll never find a Winstar case in which lost profits are appropriate, but they come pretty close. They say that we never have, and they say that in numerous cases we have rejected claims for lost profits on the ground that lost profits are too speculative to be recovered. Now, what is it about this case, now turning to foreseeability now, that distinguishes it from not only Old Stone but all the other cases that Old Stone alludes to in which lost profits have been rejected as lacking the element of foreseeability?
To begin with, Your Honor, I would cite you five cases where this court has affirmed lost profits awards, and those would be Astoria, Rochester, Globe, LaSalle, and Commercial Federal. So it is not true that this is the one-off lost profits case.
Mm-hmm.
How are we distinguishable from Old Stone? Old Stone, in fact, was not a lost profits case. The claim there was for the cost of replacement capital.
Right.
And the court awarded those costs.
And recognizing that this language is an arguably dictum, but nonetheless it's pretty considered dictum, and it goes on for a page. What is it about that analysis that makes it inapplicable, you think, to this case?
In most other cases, including the ones I just cited, the plaintiff has come to this court and said, if we had this additional capital, we would have leveraged it into some bucket of investments, like the type we already had. But I don't believe any of those cases said, here is the asset that we own that we would have continued to own. So as I said at the outset, the distinction here is an asset that we already owned, here is an asset that had a tangible lost profit stream that we're not postulating, we can actually observe and measure in the marketplace.
Right, and that works, at least arguably works, for your quantum of damages, but it doesn't seem to me it works for your foreseeability. And what Old Stone, the language in Old Stone was talking about, is foreseeability. And there, you don't have the asset in hand. You had perhaps a hope down the line to purchase the asset, but you don't have the situation that you were just describing is not present in 1983. And that seems
the situation
to me,
being that we didn't
own that you don't have the asset already.
The
in other words,
asset.
You don't have a particular asset which has a readily foreseeable course of profit making.
But again,
with a particular strategy.
Taking the discussion we just had about Namco and RFC, I would apply the very same logic to RFC and Suburban Coastal. And those were virtually identical companies from the perspective of Anchor and the benefits that Anchor received. And the government sold Suburban Coastal to Anchor as part of one of the underlying contractual acquisitions. The government was encouraging thrifts to get into mortgage banking for these various reasons of solving the problems that had created the thrift crisis in the first place. Other thrifts already owned conduits, like our private label conduits, like RFC in 1983, when the government sold Anchor Suburban Coastal. And so there is nothing that says you have to own that asset. What is clearly the case is that it was foreseeable that Anchor would have owned that type of asset because the government sold Anchor that type of asset. And in the government's 1988 exam report of Anchor, it notes that the purchase of RFC was consistent with the bank's business plan, which is our very point. We had a consistent strategy beginning in the early 1980s. The government facilitated, encouraged, and was certainly aware of, and the purchase of RFC was entirely consistent and predictable within that strategy.
Any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Fountain. Mr. Toder, and would you enlarge Mr. Toder's time by the amount we've run over? Proceed.
With respect to the questions on causation, it wasn't just the memo from Mr. Large, the CEO, to the board that explained the risk-based requirements. It was Anchor's SEC filings, as we find at A201-281 of the record. In their SEC filings explaining the reasons for the sale, Anchor stated that the capital plan also included the sale of RFC due to significant risk-based capital requirements that would be imposed on Anchor by FIREA with respect to operating a subsidiary of this nature. They said nothing about the breach or their capital levels being the reason for their sale. It was solely the risk-based capital requirements. They affirmatively identified what the reason was,
but I think
and it was
Anchor
not
would,
the breach.
I think Anchor would tell us that in their breach position, they were being exactly accurate. They couldn't meet these regulatory requirements because the breach had already endangered them so much.
Well, the risk-based capital requirements and the breach were both part of FIREA. Anchor only mentioned the risk-based capital requirements. They did not mention the breach. They did not mention their capital levels. And there were good reasons for that, because the risk-based capital requirements made it more capital intensive for a thrift like Anchor to operate RFC compared to an unregulated entity like GMAC that did not deal with those.
But it seems to me, and maybe this may just be my view and not shared by my colleagues, but on causation, it seems to me you are going right in the teeth, more than on either of the other two issues, of a very extensive analysis of each of these factors, all of this evidence by the finder of fact, who, after weighing this evidence, came out against you. And I just have a hard time seeing our way clear to say, you know what, Judge Block did not correctly assess the Lange memorandum, let's say, or the SEC filing in context and weighed against the other factors. So where you're going at specific factual issues like that, you've got a rough road to hoe, I think.
Well, the plaintiffs have a rough road to contradict their own SEC filings, where they affirmatively stated why they sold it and it wasn't the breach.
And Judge Block looked at that evidence, looked at all of the evidence, and concluded that, sure, the risk-based capital requirements had
you
an effect.
You wrote a book about this.
Right.
I have 150 pages.
They had an effect. Risk-based capital requirements had an effect, but they wouldn't have been enough without the breach.
The finding that the risk-based capital requirements, they could have gotten around them if they did all these complicated financial maneuvers promulgated by their experts for trial. Anchor's executives weren't aware of any of those mechanisms at the time they made the decision to sell RFC. So that itself is speculative, but Anchor affirmatively stated the reason, and it wasn't the breach. With respect to First Federal Lincoln, First Federal Lincoln applies to the quantum of damages, notwithstanding whether the quantum of damages would otherwise be foreseeable. If the form of damages is the disposition of an asset, page 1317, First Federal Lincoln said the most accurate measure of damages is the difference between what was received and what the value would have been but for the breach at the time of the breach, not the lost profits the asset would have generated in the future. With respect to the court's question as to whether the quantum of damages must have been foreseeable, yes, it had to have been foreseeable. That's a separate requirement from the proper way to measure damages, which is First Federal Lincoln instructs in the case of a disposition of an asset is the change in value at the time of breach. With respect to Energy Capital did state the general rule that damages should be measured for a breach of contract at the time of the breach. There is an exception to that rule recognized in Energy Capital, and that information was not available, but that information was available here because there was a disposition of an asset, there was a readily ascertainable market value, and therefore the default rule under Energy Capital that contract damages should be measured at the time of the breach also applies here, and the trial court was in error in not applying that rule of applying the damages at the time of the breach. Also, with respect to foreseeability, the fact that Anchor did not own RFC at the time of contracting only contributes to the fact that it was highly unforeseeable that they would acquire that company, that they would have to sell it rather than other things. At appendix page 209-14 in the capital plan, they state that they had alternative assets that they could sell that would raise $72 million in capital and would not have an adverse impact on the franchise. Mr. Large, the CEO, testified that at page 100-537-38 that he did not personally believe that the things that Anchor was selling, including RFC as part of the capital plan, would have an adverse impact on its franchise either. If Anchor cannot foresee harm at the time of sale, there was no way the government could have foreseen that harm 5 years earlier, and there was also no reason to depart from the default way to measure contract damages at the time of breach in this case.
Which would be the difference between $67 million and $64.4
million? Here, the trial court
for
made
RFC,
no findings.
For RFC.
The trial court made no findings as to what the
but-for
value would
have
been.
The two numbers that are floating around, or those would be the two that you would point to, right?
Here, Dr. Karen, our expert, testified that the fair value was at the high end of the range at the time. At the maximum, it would be the difference between 67 and 64.4, but here the 64.4 was certainly within the fair range. There was one estimate at between 52 and 65, so certainly it was at the high end of the acceptable ranges. At maximum, would be the difference between 67 and 64.4. I see that the red light is blinking. We respectfully request the court affirm the trial court's judgments with respect to the branch sales and wounded bank damages, with the exception of the damages for the RFC sale, and reverse the trial court's award of damages with respect to the RFC sale and the NAMCO sale and the stock proceeds offering.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Todor and Mr. Fountain. The case is taken under submission.